Well, there are two advantages to being last. The important one is that after hearing the discussion before lunch, I have adjusted my emphasis. I think that you're all more interested in human effects than I might have thought. The second advantage is everybody's sleepy and you'll let my little mistakes go. So with that, let's move on. As you can see, a great many people contributed to this. I borrowed freely from others. These are all my colleagues. That picture there This picture here is evocative about of a film clip that I saw that made me very angry and upset. A Marine convoy was driving through Iraq, and small boys came up and threw big rocks at the Marines. I mean, these were rocks that could really hurt you. And the precious part of that film was the comments of the Marines about how they were not allowed to shoot the little so-and-sos. Well, if the Marines had an acoustic weapon like this, they might have at least been able to keep the little buggers out of range. But they don't have one yet. This is an outline of what I'm going to go through. I will skip a lot of this, especially for this group, who doesn't need this instruction. But I'll tell you a little bit about our institute. I'm listed as the chief scientist for Penn State here, which will be a big shock to the vice president for research at the university. I am the chief scientist for this little institute that we have. Acoustics in warfare has a colorful history. A lot of myths and misconceptions. Go through some of the work we have done. We've done extensive testing of hail and warning devices, who are perhaps the grandparents of what may be developed into acoustic weapons. Some of them have been used in that fashion. And I'll give you my working definition. And this is a steerable acoustic array that we have developed. And here's this big issue that Dr. Murphy referred to eloquently today regarding electromagnetics, but it's a very big issue here too. And then that's only one slide, so it won't do us any harm. The Institute was formed in late 1997. I joined the university in 1998, so I was in pretty much the beginning of it. Colonel Andy Mazzara became director in 2000. Colonel Mazzara was the first director of the Joint Non-Lethal Weapons Directorate, so he came to us with a very good pedigree and a great understanding of what needs to be done. One of the most important things that we have done in our attempts to focus on human effects is we've established the human effects advisory panels. And one of my colleagues, Dr. John Kenny, heads this panel. And this is an interesting approach that might be useful in other fields as well. There are a lot of questions that cannot be decided by traditional mathematical, engineering, or even experimental studies. What we do with these panels, what Dr. Kenny does so well, is he gathers subject matter experts and he guides them through discussions and they end up writing an assessment of the question at hand. And this works quite well, especially in the area of human effects where experiments, analysis are very difficult to come by. Our charter is basically to do good stuff in the area of non-lethal weaponry and methodologies, technologies, and scientific efforts as well. Some of our research thrust, we have done work in all of these areas. I headed up a little project to look into some aspects of a non-lethal solid-state laser. Is it feasible? Our answer is yes. We're hoping to get some follow-on funding in order to build the prototype. We have participated in various ways in some of this other weaponology. Sometimes it's an assessment, sometimes it's a human effects panel, sometimes it's actually an engineering study. So it's quite varied. One of the advantages we have is that we're a large university and we can reach into the university and pull out experts. For example, I recently did a human effects study on flashing lights, which are being designed in something that looks like a flashlight. Police officer can shine it in your face, and it leaves you leave your vision impaired just for a few moments, and they can cuff you, take the weapon away from you, and so we do these kinds of studies. And I've got to go through all the stuff that Dr. Murphy described. Got to go before a a panel, explain why we're not going to injure anybody, explain why this has enough merit in order for them to allow us to use human subjects. It's quite a process. So there's no need to belabor this slide. We do have some work ongoing with the police forces. We have a number of these are some of the projects that we are doing under the sponsorship of the Joint Non-Lethal Weapons Program. We did the first less than lethal, police term, munitions testing, where we compared blunt impact munitions side by side. Never been done before. We did that some years ago. It became a best-selling report. So I think we're about to do some more of that, and we're actually trying to set up a test range. I don't know if we'll be able to do that, but we'll find a range somewhere to do these things. We have a number of law enforcement efforts. We have a contract from the National Institutes for Justice to provide general support. Seemed like a lot of money, but it's gone already. I got in line too late, so I didn't get any of that money. But my colleagues have launched a number of projects, including trying to understand the lethality of the taser, which is a question that refuses to die, even though there have been hundreds of thousands of tasings, no provable taser deaths at all. Do a lot of work with the Marine Corps. The U.S. Army has a behavioral response work going on at Picatinny Arsenal, the RDEC, the Army Research Engineering Development Center, and we've done some work with them, and we do some work with private industry. Okay. First use of acoustics in warfare. Joshua blew the horn and the walls came down. I wish we had a weapon like that. It's a good story. So that perhaps inspired people later. This is a truism. This is a picture that I think appeared in a patent application. But this was a serious effort. You know, we were sailing boats up and down the Mississippi and crashing into things. So they were using sound to steer through fog, and Professor Mayer developed this as a means of steering towards a sound. Someone would stand on the river and blow a horn, and he'd steer towards it and stay away from the rocks in the middle of the river that he couldn't see because of the fog. Now, aircraft localization. This was a very serious effort, pre-radar. In fact, I read somewhere that a picture like this was used as a propaganda device to confuse our enemies during World War II about whether we were detecting them with electromagnetically or acoustically. I don't think it fooled anybody very long, but it was a good try. Here are some nice pictures. Look at this one. Isn't that a beautiful device? And of course, there's the French one. Being French, it's a little more elegant than the others, but there it is. And this was a German one that worked quite well. They could detect aircraft up to 12 kilometers away with a directional accuracy of about 2 degrees, and that's good enough to vector your fighter planes out there. But of course, it was all superseded by radar. Now, I think Britain gets the prize for the biggest ones. That's the operator's hut. This is a big parabolic dish that collects sound and is very directional, and this one is even bigger. I wonder what they're doing with these things now. So, psychological warfare. We all have heard the siren that was put on the German Stuka dive bomber. It was very effective. It terrified people. They'd hear that scream, and it would terrify them. In Korea, the North Koreans often put out trumpet blasts and verbal threats. These two, I personally doubt the effectiveness of this. I don't like some of the loud music they play, but I don't know that it would drive me out to be shot. But that was the attempt that was made in any case. So present-day battlefields use acoustics as sensors and locators for psychological operations. This is a function on anti-terrorist battlefield operations that is very important. We've seen some tragedies occur in Iraq because we did not have effective hail and warning devices to get people out of the way, to stop. There was this very sad event where an Italian newsman who had escaped from his captors was coming down the road in a car at high speed. They couldn't talk to him, and he kept coming to the checkpoint. The soldiers fired in what they thought was self-defense and killed an innocent man. So hail and warning is an important one. Area denial is something that a lot of people talk about with regard to acoustics, and We'll go into that a little more later on. I mean, it's going to take some pretty loud sources to do that, and we have to. I think we can develop them, but before that, we've got to get permission to use some higher intensity sound. And this is all the same stuff. Operations other than war means generally peacekeeping missions. I heard a very moving presentation by a lieutenant colonel of the U.S. Army who was in the Balkans and said he'd wished he'd had something like a good hail and warning device. It would have avoided a lot of trouble. This is what some of these devices look like. I did use more compact versions of things like this when my days when I worked on the Pershing program, when we were trying to hide the Pershings in the German and Belgian forests, and we would put out ground sensors to detect intruders. And because obviously if war started in Europe, the first thing that was going to happen was that special forces were going to come in and try to locate the Pershings, which were there to break up Soviet concentrations. And so our devices were about that size, about so big, with little radio antennas on it that could detect acoustically, seismically, and with infrared. Now, the misconceptions about acoustics are just legion. And this was a New York Times article, and thanks to this guy's ridiculous claims, it got us started in this world. I mean, you just have to read this. And 120 dB did this to him. I don't know. I seriously doubt that. As a result of this article, the U.S. Marine Corps asked us to evaluate the LRAD, the long-range acoustic device, which they had bought quite a number and are used even now in Iraq. And we'll talk about that device. But this raised some concerns among Congress people and others that we were causing all kinds of harm to people with intense sound. So we were asked to develop some guidelines. We'll go into it a little later. But first, let's put infrasound to bed. These are claims, and yet I don't know of any objective information that looks into this. Mike, do you that supports these claims on any scientific basis or any systematically? All the information I've seen indicate that infrasound has little, if any, effect on people.
At 170 dB, I think it certainly does.
On monkeys, yes, but
and at 106, I think we've gone down to 164. Okay. Still got massive effects on monkeys. And
well,
I think you would get that on humans.
Well, there's no. I haven't seen any indications. There are no systematic studies that it has an effect. But look what it takes to produce something like that. I mean,
yeah,
you need it becomes ridiculously large and heavy devices with an enormous amount of power. They're just not going to be practical. Now, there may be some effects. There are some people who are extremely sensitive to very low frequency noises, but they seem to be few and far between from what we understand. Ultrasound. Ultrasound is a non-starter because it's absorbed so rapidly in air. It actually does a little better underwater than it does in air. The U.S. Navy uses some very high frequency transducers to search for mines, 100,000 hertz, 300 kilohertz. And the thing they like about that is that the high absorption in seawater eliminates a lot of the background noise. So if you're looking for a tethered mine, it's up in the water on a cable. What goes past it and hits the bottom is absorbed much more than the part that's reflected from that, so it works well there. But in air, this is what you're faced with. That's the impedance mismatch between air and tissue. So if you think you're going to take 300 watts to cause an effect, that's what you need to transmit. That's a lot of power. In fact, ultrasound is used extensively in medical applications for imaging and also for breaking up tumors. And in order to get enough energy into tissue to do that, they've got to use special gels that will connect the head of the device to it. Now, We developed safety guidelines for the long-range acoustic device. We did some studies on aversive sounds. Which sounds are most aversive to people? The general principle is that the more variable it is, the less predictable it is, the more effective it will be. When we did these studies, we found that there were some differences between various waveforms, but intensity of sound just overwhelmed these differences in waveform. So you needed something intense, and then you could tailor it a bit and make it work. We ran studies where we first asked opinions, then we had people trying to perform tasks while listening to intense sound, and it is true, you could distract people, you could confuse them a little, but 100 decibels was our limit. That's all we could get through the human human subject panels, and at 100 dB you're not going to turn anybody away. I mean, you're listening to something close to that when you're mowing your lawn, so that's not going to turn people away. Could it provide our troops a couple of more seconds to make a decision? Perhaps. And that few seconds could be useful. We did a comparative evaluation of commercially available hail and warning devices. I'll run through some of those quickly so you can see how big they are and how well they do. And then we finally, after doing this, we decided to develop a steerable acoustic array. And I've just completed this, about a year-long study of bioacoustic effects. And this is what I'm trying to do at this time. I've requested and managed, after 3 or 4 visits to the human, to the Institutional Review Board panel, I managed to get a 130 dB limit through. I can apply 130 dB to humans, according to Penn State University, for a grand total of 48 seconds a day. And now I'm going to try to get one through the DOD somehow, because we're using DOD money and we have to get their approval as well. This was a difficult process. The people on the panel were very skeptical, as they often are and they should be. And I had to visit that panel 3 different times. Each time I left with a new set of questions and I had to go back. The long-range acoustic device looks like this. It's about a meter across and about so thick. There's an array of some, I forget the exact number, 27 off-the-shelf projectors. They did a very good job of building this thing. It's plug and play. You can buy one, you can plug it into your Humvee, you can plug it into the wall and use it. And that's one reason they sold so many of them. The U.S. Army's bought a lot of them. The Marine Corps bought a lot of them. They are in use in Iraq right now. Here is one mounted on a military vehicle, and you can see the relative size. It was designed as an acoustic hail and warning device. The failing that it has is simply this. It has a very poor low-frequency response. Below about 800 hertz, there's not much energy there. It peaks right where the human hearing is the most sensitive, at about 2900 hertz. So when they put out their warble device at 2900 hertz, it's really quite arresting. Police sirens and ambulance sirens, you work around that frequency too for that reason. But in terms of intelligibility at a distance, the low frequencies are very important because they propagate further than the high frequencies do, and they'll refract around objects. So if someone's behind a tree 50 meters away, he'll hear the lows better than he'll hear the highs. Also, in terms of a country like Iraq, where a man's voice is much more authoritative than a woman's voice, the man's voice doesn't propagate as well as the woman's voice would on LRAD. So we were asked to conduct a safety analysis of this, and this is the manufacturer's claim, and what we measured was actually pretty close to that. We've been through all of this, and they tried to influence crowds and determine hostile event. Area denial, you can try to drive people away with it. You will drive some people away. Some you won't drive away. I don't believe that you'll drive a determined attacker away with 100 decibels or 110 decibels. This is a picture that apparently is in everybody's presentation because it is indicative of the problems that were faced. I got this picture from the presentation very moving presentation given by an American officer about his experiences during the disturbances in the former Yugoslavia. So we established safe operating parameters, we looked at the literature, we developed algorithms, but more importantly, we went out and we measured what LRAD could do. And not only do we measure it, but Penn State University has certainly one of the premier acoustics programs in the world. We give a master's degree and a PhD in acoustics. And so we did some urban modeling. And the question is this. I'm beaming my LRAD in that direction, and there's a wall behind you. Is that going to exceed acceptable hearing limits? Well, the answer is no, because it's only at most another 3 decibels, and we modeled all of that urban environments, putting it through windows, putting it through glass, and so on, and then we actually went in the field and measured it, and we find that there's about a 30 dB insertion loss into a vehicle with the windows rolled up. So if you want to pump in 90 decibels to make sure that you're being understood, you're going to need to put out 120 decibels at whatever range that vehicle is in. So power is important. And this is what we ended up making. I've got the last one left. We made up 100 of these things. They're plastic. They're about so big. One of them hangs off of every LRAD in Iraq, they tell me. And fundamentally, it says, if someone is within 50 meters, do not turn the power up all the way. And as was mentioned by others, soldiers in the field will find ways to use devices that you never dreamed of. And occasionally I've gotten emails from Iraq, which I refer to the Joint Directorate, because I'm not authorized to talk to the troops in the field. They say things such as, I used it to do this, I like it, I need to do this more, and I need to do that, you need to do that more with this. It was used in Iraq, this device was used to help put down a prison riot. There is a hail and warning device that was used as an acoustic weapon. So these prisoners came out into the yard, they would not go back in, and they used a couple of LRADs to drive them off the field. Now that's a very close range. This thing, the LRAD puts out something like a neighborhood of 142 decibels at a meter. So if these folks are only 20 meters away, they're getting a pretty healthy dose. It's spherical spreading. So they're probably getting 120 dB. We participated in this program. The Joint Directorate tasked the Army Research Engineering Development Center to conduct a comparison of all commercially available acoustic hailing devices, and we provided acoustic support for that. And the way this worked was is all the manufacturers were asked to propose their devices for evaluation, and based on what they told us in their literature, and based on what we saw of the devices, we made a committee selected the ones to be tested. Sometimes they were rejected because they were erector sets. They weren't plug and play and not even close to it. And sometimes they were rejected because they were too cumbersome. But we did choose a couple that had some unique features just because they were so different. This is a big, very capable device, but it's extremely heavy, requires a lot of power, and broke down frequently. That's the LRAD 1000. This is the LRAD 500. Much less power than the LRAD 1000, but we thought this would be useful in urban environments where you couldn't even use the range of the LRAD because of the streets won't allow you to. I mean, you're basically talking about a 50 meter, 75 meter device is what you need, and it's so much lighter and less expensive. We included it. I think I've told you all this already. This is very important, and now this seems self-evident, but we had trouble convincing people of this, and it wasn't until they came to our demonstration, and I drove them around in a van, and I'd go down the radio, and I said, okay, give us the message. And they couldn't hear it at 100 meters, my goodness, because it was a 30 dB insertion loss, so I rolled down the window, and then they could hear it and understand somewhat. And it, this is important, especially for naval applications, where the a terrorist might be coming at you in a boat, and he's got this noisy engine behind him, or he's in a cabin. I mean, these are all the things that have to be modeled. When you see manufacturers' claims, we can communicate at 500 meters, you have to say to yourself, not if they're in a boat with a noisy engine, not if they're inside a vehicle with the windows rolled up. All these factors need to be taken into account in terms of laying out the scenarios in which you will use these devices. This is the LRAD 500. I'll just go through this one a little bit. I won't go through all of them. It weighs 26 pounds. It's very nice. It comes in a case. You can carry it around like a small suitcase. The current version is a little different than this. These pictures are about 18 months old, and some of the manufacturers have improved their devices. It comes with a bright light in it so that you can use a light as well as sound, and that's a very good thing. It's rugged, and it was ready. It was a plug and play. But if you want to communicate with somebody at 500 meters, that's not the device for you. It's not powerful enough. This is the LRAD 1000. It's bigger, costs more. It's also ready to plug and play. And that's been improved quite a bit since this picture was taken as well. Here are some of the others. I won't go through them all. This one had a ruggedness rating of 5. It's based on our testing experience. You know, if the thing didn't break much, or if we dropped it and then it wouldn't work anymore, why we made a judgment and gave it a rating. That's this big fellow. Very good projection authority, because it can put out loads. These are magnetic projectors. They're not the normal kind of projectors. That's why it's called the magnetic, I forget what the A stands for, device. This is the PSR 42. The military's bought quite a number of these. They're often deployed from helicopters to use as hail and warning devices. And here is another very good one. So on. There's one I want to get to. Now, this thing is an amazing gadget. It's built by the Chinese, and what you don't see behind it is there's a trailer truck size compressor to drive this thing. And before it starts broadcasting its size, it goes, and then the words start coming out. This was built to broadcast propaganda to Taiwan from the mainland. I saw a film of this thing dispersing fog. It puts out 162 dB is the claim, and that's about what we measured. And they showed this foggy scene. They turned this thing on, and the fog was gone. It all condensed out of the air. That's a powerful device, but I mean, I don't know if you Europeans are familiar with what we call Rube Goldberg devices. They're these gadgets that have gears, and a chicken lays an egg, and it rolls down the slope into a funnel. And this is a real Rube Goldberg. There's no doubt that it's effective. And we got to test one, because the American agent for this thing is actually only 30 miles from the university, 30 or 40 miles from the university. So they called and wanted to know if they could come to our test, and we said, sure, come on. You know, we were curious. We never got to test the Israeli device, the one that's currently called Shout. They were very clever in their use of that as psychological warfare, because the Israeli military attaché told me that they use a simulator, and they play tank sounds through it, and the crowds just disappear. They hear the tanks coming, and they're gone. He said, but they seem to be learning, and so it has some limited utility. I've been invited to Israel to see it operate, and they told me if I liked it enough, they would fly one to the U.S. for our testing. And when I asked the director if I could do that, they said, you can't spend our money to do that, but if you want to spend the university's money, go ahead. And the university said, can't spend our money, but if you want to spend the director's, you know the argument. Anyhow, I'm anxious to see that. I've heard it. I've heard recordings of it. It seems to be a very good device. It, too, is an array. It's an array that fits in the back of a pickup truck. All right. Now, are these things that we've looked at, are they acoustic weapons? In some sense, they are. I mean, hail and warning is a weapon. You know, get off the battlefield or I'm going to shoot you. I don't know what your message would be. The U.S. Navy has decreed a 500-yard exclusion zone around the ships, and they'd like to be able to tell people who are coming into that zone, you are crossing into the exclusion zone. If you continue to come, we're going to fire upon you. So is that a weapon? It's a non-lethal device used for non-lethal purposes. Psychological warfare, I think currently the Israeli broadcasting tank sounds is probably the most interesting and effective such a device. And this is a traditional battlefield function. Now, we can achieve annoyance and distraction. We've measured it. We even had psychologists evaluating it for us. How effective was it? How did it work? But it's not a weapon in the sense that, say, a blunt impact weapon is, or even what a non-lethal laser would be. It does not deter people. It does not turn them around the way the ADS would. I don't know that you can deter people acoustically without causing serious damage to their hearing. But from the studies we have done, and the studies the Army have done, and others have done, it seems to us that we're going to have to be able to expose people to 120 to 130 dB in order to cause any kind of deterrence that looks like stopping an aggressor or turning him away. We don't yet know if this will work. Because even after, I'm getting ahead of myself, after our extensive review of bioacoustic data, and I mean we went through hundreds if not thousands of references, medical, engineering, acoustical society, I mean there's an enormous amount of data on bioacoustics, but most of it has to do with things like how does the cochlea work. We can model that quite well. What's the effect of the movement of the stapes on hearing acuity? Almost none of it has to do with behavior modification. Our little studies at 100 dB and the Army's studies at 115 dB tried to look into behavior modification, and we agree with the Army that 115 dB isn't enough. 120, 125, perhaps 130 dB will be necessary, and that will plunk us right into the pond called hearing safety standards. I don't think I need to tell this group about this equation, except to note that underwater it's all different, because sound couples into the human body very well underwater. The U.S. Navy has done studies to determine diver safety in the vicinity of their acoustic arrays. The Royal Marines ran a test where they put Marines volunteers in the water and insonified them, and they all wanted out. They claimed that the common claim was that their lungs felt extremely full, which of course is because the sound is penetrating into the body. In air, there's at least a 30 decibel insertion loss, if not more. But this is what we call infrasound. It's not practical to generate infrasound as a weapon. Ultrasound won't propagate, so we're in this regime. And the bio data indicates that if we're going to be effective as a deterrent weapon, it's going to have to be in the vicinity of, say, 300 hertz up to several kilohertz, perhaps. This is just telling us that spherical spreading seems to apply, and I'll show you a better chart that has more stuff on it than this. This is about where eardrum rupture will occur. This is about where pain occurs, and this is the region that I think we're going to have to operate in. And if you have 160 dB at the source, you can see it drops off pretty fast. Diffraction is the bending of radiation, and we'll more about this. And of course, you've got the Doppler effects as well as you do with any kind of radiation. So we'll say more about this in a later slide. This is how we end up computing the transmission coefficient from air into water and vice versa, and into the human body. It's based on the density and the speed of sound in the medium of interest. the human body has a density and speed of sound that is comparable to water. So here's the loss that occurs. It's only 0.11%. That's 0.11%, not 11, with sound in the humans. And so it's a very inefficient thing to do. So when we talk about influencing humans, it's unlikely we can do it through going into the chest cavity and shaking lungs. Most likely, it's going to be something that comes in through the ears. And there is a little hope there. Here's directivity is important. This is for a long wavelength, and the higher the frequency, the more directive a projector is in accordance with this formula. I'm a physicist, after all. I like formulas. This is a Bessel function. And we can use these in order to determine how we can produce arrays that will produce narrow beams. Here's our picture, and what do we have to do to weaponize audible sound? These are all the questions we have to face. Our first concept of this array was actually after talking to some Navy personnel. They would love to have arrays on the hulls of ships that could be electronically steered, so you don't have to turn the ship, or you don't have to have somebody on deck exposed turning the device and pointing it. This is a picture of some sea pirates who attacked a cruise ship off the coast of Somalia. And we'll talk about them a little more later. This is a chart that these are average effects. Again, start with eardrum rupture and 130 dB. These are sounds, we've all heard sounds this loud and we still can hear. This is a jet takeoff at 50 meters. This is a snowmobile, a lawnmower. It's 100 dB. I mean, we get out there and we mow our lawn for an hour and it doesn't ruin our hearing. And it doesn't do much to us in other ways. So this is typical sounds, and these are the associated noise levels. This is dBA. That means relative to the human hearing thresholds. Now, here's a diagram of the human hearing apparatus and the vestibular system. Back in 1978, I hate to give the general more ammunition for his Air Force gun, the Air Force did this study, and they found that with certain waveforms, they could induce eye movements acoustically. Now, that was not new. There are textbooks that predate this, medical textbooks, that talk about the affecting the vestibular system with high-intensity sound. This was back in the days when human effects boards were not quite so severe, so the Air Force used up to 150 dB to do this. And it indicates that you can get sound into the semicircular canals through the cochlea. It goes in, and there is something called the saccule, which shares a fluid bath between the cochlea and these. And as you'll see later on, a bit down the road here, I'll show you a plot where it shows where the maxima for various frequencies occur within the cochlea. And the 500 hertz to a kilohertz, which occur right about where this is just where they got their maximum effect. So that's pretty good indication that they were getting sound into the semicircular canals through the cochlea. So we haven't found any other non-auditory physiological effects. There isn't much data between 120 and 150 dB because of concerns for human safety. But we know this, you get discomfort at 120, you get pain at 140, and this again is where the literature falls very short. You can talk about physiological effects. Did you damage the cochlea? Did you rupture the eardrum? But did you affect people's behavior? There's very little, very, very little on that. So we had our jury trials. We were limited. And this is the Targeted Behavioral Response Laboratory at the Army Research Development and Engineering Center. And we've all concluded we need higher sound pressure levels. Here's a calculation. This is a 500 hertz line. This is a kilohertz line. That's 200 hertz. And right around here is where the entrance to the saccule exists. And this is a calculation based on a very accurate model of cochlear behavior. They use finite element analysis and some other mathematical techniques to make these kinds of calculations. All right, here's the pirate attack on the Seaborne Spirit. This happened 2005 off the coast of Somalia. They wanted to hijack this boat. And so the boat had an LRAD, and they beamed it on these guys. Now, did it drive them away? Well, they went away. So you can, but as they were going away, they kept on shooting. They actually shot a hole in the LRAD, and it kept on operating because the bullet missed all the transducers. And so, now of course, the manufacturer of the LRAD spread this around. They claim that it drove the pirates away. Maybe it did, maybe it didn't. I don't know. We never got to interview these guys. You know, why did you leave? There could be other reasons. But this is a case in point. This is a very effective device. Have any of you seen that little film clip that appeared on television about a prison riot in the United States, and there was this courtyard full of rioting prisoners, and they threw a bunch of these out there, and they all went into their cells? This is a very startling thing. If you've never seen one of these go off, it's a 180 dB peak. I mean, is that right, Mike? About 180 dB? But it's very short duration. So it doesn't have time to do you much damage. And the flash, along with the bang, is a very startling effect, and it works. At least it works, unless you use it repeatedly. I suppose people would eventually learn that these things aren't going to do them any harm. So what scenarios? What can we use acoustics for? Well, it depends on how intense a sound you're allowed to use and what kind of device you have. Is it steerable? Is it portable? Can you put out 130 dB? All those questions have to be answered before you can go into this. So this is the things we'd like to do. We all think, many of us think, that acoustic weapons would be more effective when combined with light. Now, the recent light experiments we did with humans are going to be supplemented. We're going to introduce some sound as well and see if we got more effective results by introducing, say, 100 decibels as well as a bright light in the face. The insertion loss, this is a review of a lot of stuff we've already mentioned. 100 kilowatts of electrical power converted into sound with 100% efficiency can produce these kinds of levels. They are achievable with current technology. The standards that we use are twofold in the main, although there are other standards related to these. The Occupational Safe and Healthy Administration, the MIL standard 1474D, is the military standards it's used. These are designed to protect people over a 40-year working life. We're contemplating exposing people for a moment or two, perhaps once in their lifetime, perhaps twice in a week, something like that. And these are the standards. They're pretty much limited to 90 decibels, and then you use exchange rates to go to higher levels. The MIL standard is very conservative. It cuts the allowable exposure time in half for every 3 decibels that you move up. The OSHA standards cut the exposure time in half by 5 decibels every time you move up. I got my 130 dB protocol through by using OSHA standards, and then I had to go get an audiologist to say that he didn't think this would damage people's hearing. And that finally got it through the board. So this is, and furthermore, even if we adhere to these standards, people's hearing deteriorates with age. I mean, and who knows, whether it was because they worked in a shop or they were going to lose their hearing anyway, we just don't know. Well, one reference says they allow for a 2% loss in hearing. 2% of the population will lose some hearing over a working life. Now, directivity is important. Because if you have a sound pressure level of 159 dB with 100,000 watts and you spread it over 360 degrees, these are the levels you get. If you can limit it to a narrower beam, you can do a lot better. I mean, 173 dB is far more intense than 159 dB. And this is another presentation. This is the critical place where we want to be, where we are between discomfort and a higher degree of discomfort. And this is the information available. Now, this is a good picture because it shows you how exposed the operators would be if we simply mounted a device on top of a vehicle like that. And furthermore, the operator's field of view isn't very good, and the fixed beam pattern is not really optimal for pinpointing targets. So we notionally put together a phased array. We have a digital signal processor, and the output from each speaker can be varied individually, and the relative phases can be varied by means of the digital signal processor. These are our notional drawings of how you might use it. For the Navy, they can control it from on shipboard, sweep it, follow the device, follow the boat, and make sure they're hearing them. This could even be operated at a distance. So it's a more secure operator location. You have the array stationary, and the beam can be steered electronically or electromagnetically, and that's what we do. Thing can be scalable. We can make a configuration small enough for Humvees and even bigger ones for large ships that require a greater range of operation. We could have some automatic compensation for wind and temperature-induced effects. This is the product theorem. This is well-known geometry. There's nothing mysterious about this, and this is the mathematics we used in order to design our phasing and our amplitude summations. Now, by staggering this half a unit over, you can get effectively a wider device with the same number of units. We call a unit two projectors. So you can put as many units as you like. Below a 1600 hertz, you don't get any grating loads. No matter how good your device is, when you start phasing them together, you have some side lobes, grating lobes. People who have done work in sonar will recognize that. That is a serious problem in sonar. So we can steer over angles of about 60 degrees and using some small horns. Now, here is our original concept was putting the pods like this, and we would get, these are the side lobes that I mentioned. But if you can pivot the pods a little, which is pretty easy to do, we've done that, our prototype does this, you can have even a greater sweep, angular sweep than the original 60 degrees. So you get a directional beam, high output, and better maintains sound pressure levels than it would otherwise. You can use large arrays in spaces that would have been impossible for conventional devices. Now, here are some measurements that we made at 800 hertz and at for a 2x3 array and a 2x8. This is the beam width for a 2x3 array, and this is the beam width for a 2x8 array. You can see that there's a big improvement the more elements you put in to the thing. Here is our first prototype. And believe it or not, this thing weighs 220 pounds, so it's not overly heavy. It is pretty big. Now, we're building a new one with much smaller pods that we found for sale. I think actually they came from Germany, but they're much smaller pods, put out the same amount of power in a smaller unit. Now, meteorological effects can be severe, especially if you're talking about communicating out to 1,500 meters. Now, you can't communicate out to 1,500 meters with about 145 dB if it's a quiet day. But winds, temperature gradients can bend these things around. There is one of the U.S. government laboratories that's trying to build a system that will tell you how much refraction you're getting so that we can correct for it back at the source. That's not yet proven, but they're working on it. These are measurements that we actually made. There were 30 dB variations, even at a range as short as 200 meters, because of day-night conditions. Now, that sounds like a lot. Talk to sonar people. That's not too bad if you're operating at a range scaled up for sonar. Distributed sound and light array debilitator. This has a dazzler array. These are the acoustic projectors. And there's a camera here so that, and a laser designator, so you know exactly what you're seeing and you know exactly what you're pointing at. This is under construction now at Penn State University. So, hearing safety standards, that's the big problem. There is a DOD directive that says that non-lethal weapons are not intended to injure, but does allow for some injury. We may have to somehow use that as a basis for selecting standards that are suitable for weapons and as opposed to working lives. So the we've conducted our review of bioacoustic data, and this is the operative term. There are no acoustic weapon standards that we were able to find. The Army Research Lab has developed a computer model for acoustic injury due to pulses. And the way it works is this, and for users. You input a pulse shape, and then it computes auditory damage units. And you're allowed up to 500 auditory damage units per 24-hour day. And here is a graph for different frequencies. This is the duration, and this is the number of units. For example, at 1.25 kilohertz, you can see you can go out for a half hour without exceeding the 500 auditory damage units. The calculation is based on a knowledge of hearing and some data, models of the cochlea and the cochlear reactions to data. It's also based on how fast the rise time is in this pulse. How fast does this pulse rise? Because there is a mechanism in the middle ear. It's a muscle that when you hear the onset of a loud sound, it clamps down and limits the propagation of the disturbance through the bones of the middle ear to the cochlea. It's a self-protecting mechanism for the cochlea. If the pulse has a very quick rise time, that muscle doesn't have time to respond. So that is one of the factors they included in their model. This is another way to present all this information. This was a 100 millisecond pulse with onset, offset times of 1 millisecond. This is a very nice way to present the information. And here's another way to present the information. Sound pressure level versus frequency, and this tells you these are auditory damage unit thresholds. Here's the 500 damage threshold limit as a function of frequency and sound pressure level. Now, can we deter aggressions? That's the basic question. What are the mechanisms that can be exploited? We can't answer the first question fully yet, although there are anecdotes such as the pirate attack and some others. There are some mechanisms, cochlear stimulation, so-called cochlear resonance. What they mean by that is that you'll get a lot of energy through the saccule into the semicircular canals and cause perhaps some disorientation or some other kind of discomfort that might deter people, slow them down, or even turn them away. But again, we need higher sound pressure levels. Hearing safety standards, we've been through this, has to be reworked. And here's the question that sponsors sometimes ask. They didn't ask it here, but we answered it anyway. Should additional studies be undertaken? My scientist heart aches as I say no, because, as you know, we all like studies. But it wouldn't get us any closer to a non-lethal acoustic weapon. What is needed is a demonstration. Can we show the deterrent effects of sound? That's what I'm trying to do by getting a 130 dB protocol. If I can show that it's possible, then we can study the aspects of it we need to study in order to optimize it as a weapon. In order to show it, I've got to get the human protocol completed. So here's a summary, and I hear all the sighs of relief. We're already using these devices. We use flashbang devices. This was used for Seaborne Spirit, and I'm sure the troops in the field are finding other ways to use these things that nobody anticipated. We'd like to conduct all of these missions, disrupt, deter, push back, clear crowds. We think that acoustics will be most effective when combined with other things such as optical devices. Physiological effects, yet to be fully determined. So this demonstration is the next logical step because we have not yet found much information on behavior modification using intense sound. Any questions, please? Yes.
I want to understand that there's a one-to-one correlation between...
Thanks. Is there a one-to-one correlation between the frequencies at which there's audible quality and where you also acquire damage units? Meaning, are the same frequencies at where damage is experienced, those same exact same frequencies where we can also generate good audible quality? Are there any audible qualities that don't have the damage effect? It's a one-to-one.
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Well, if you go back to that chart where you showed accrual damage units as a function of frequency.
This one?
No.
That one?
Right, that one.
Okay.
Are any of those frequencies down in the bottom that where you do not acquire as many units as a function of time still effective in design of a propagation system?
Yes. Let's take the 500 hertz line. That's down in here.
I guess what I'm asking is, do any of those frequencies on the bottom where you are not acquiring damage units quickly, do any of them have the same messaging efficiency as those three in the top?
In order to transmit intelligible speech, you've got to transmit a mixture of frequencies. If I'm transmitting in a way where the high frequencies are absorbed, you know, you'll hear a different voice, but down to about 500 hertz, you'll still be able to understand a lot of it. But your implication is correct. If you eliminate a lot of these upper frequencies, you cut down on the intelligibility as well. Now, I'm talking here, I'm referring to using these safer frequencies as a means of deterring people rather than communicating with them. If I want to communicate with them, I need frequencies up through about here. They're not terribly damaging either, but you know, you'll hear a funny voice, but you'll be able to understand it. And at great ranges, the lower frequencies transmit better, go propagate better than the higher frequencies. I don't know if I answered your question or not, did I? No, it's a good question. It's a good question. I mean, if I can't transmit frequencies that are intelligible because they're going to cause too much damage, then I can't communicate. But the point is that at the longer ranges, they won't be that damaging.
I'm also curious as to the correlation efficiency, whether it's one-to-one between pain and accrual of those damage units there that you are time limiting. Meaning, is there a possibility to generate damage without generating pain?
I rather doubt it. I don't know for sure, but I rather doubt it. I think if you're going to cause damage, it's going to hurt.
I think you can generate cumulative damage. One of the largest claims that the Veterans Administration has for disability of former service members is auditory damage, hearing damage. And I seriously doubt that 30% of the veterans population has undergone a painful sound experience.
Oh, that's certainly true. I mean, it accumulates day by day as they're exposed. Yes, that's right. It is cumulative. It can be cumulative. But again, I'm talking about single incidents or a handful of incidences, a handful of events, as
opposed to prompt damage.
Prompt damage, that's right.
As a 35-year fighter pilot, I can tell you that you guys may have been talking, but I haven't been hearing.
Any other questions? All right, thank you for your attention.